Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for the introduction and for the invitation to come and talk at this session. So continuing on the theme of peer review then, what I'm going to try, and the theme of my talk is about how you can separate two functions of peer review that are traditionally wrapped up in a single process. And so the idea of separating impact assessment from technical assessment, and I'll go through and explain what that means and what some of the potential benefits are of taking that kind of approach. But first, just a very quick introduction to PLOS. We launched ourselves as a non-profit open access publisher in 2003, launched two flagship journals, PLOS Biology and PLOS Medicine, launched some community journals in 2005 that are more traditionally run academic journals that have become also high prestige journals in their own right. And then PLOS One came along, the journal that I'm mostly going to be talking about, in 2006. So we've got seven journals in that time. But we also do other things as well. And broadly, this is connected with our sort of broader statement of our mission, really, which is about thinking about how you can take research communication from a system that's been adapted and evolved to print to a new medium, to digital media, and all the things that potentially can be changed and improved in that way. So we've got projects like Article Level Metrics, which I'll talk about, PLOS Hubs, which is another post-publication tool that I'll talk about, and one other thing, which is also quite experimental, called PLOS Currents, which we launched a couple of years ago, where the goal is to have a completely online workflow, beginning with authoring online and taking the whole thing through to publication, and as a means of really reducing cost, reducing time associated with publishing. But I'm not going to say any more about PLOS Currents today. So going back to peer review then. Broadly speaking, you can kind of divide the questions that peer review and the editorial process is attempting to answer into two kinds of things. One is assessing the claim. How important is the claim in this work? And is it important enough for my journal? And is it relevant to the audience of my journal? That's a typical question that's asked. And then the second part of that is that claim reliable? Is the methodology and the data and so on, do they justify that claim? And so that's what I mean about dividing these two functions into the assessment of impact and technical assessment, and thinking about whether you can separate these things and what might happen if you do. But traditionally, these things are wrapped up in a single process that goes on before publication. And so in some ways, you can think of journals as like a giant sorting mechanism, also a pretty slow sorting mechanism. Mark mentioned the 1.5 million articles that are published every year. Before those articles see the light of day, they're filtered and sorted into 25,000 different journals. Is that the right way? You know, it makes sense in print to organize things that way. Does it make sense in a digital medium to do it that way? We think there are other ways of thinking about this. And in particular, because online you can do stuff to content after it's been published. You can add value and you can organize and do all sorts of things to content after it's published, all the more so if that content's open access, because open access is about reducing access barriers, but more importantly, reducing reuse barriers. So you can do whatever you want with this content after publication. And it was that kind of thinking that led to the sort of vision for PLOS One. And really, the people that should take the credit for that vision are Pat Brown and Mike Eisen, two of the founders of the Public Library of Science. So we launched PLOS One at the end of 2006. So what makes PLOS One different is really very straightforward. It's just the set of editorial criteria that we use during the editorial process and during peer review to assess the submission. So essentially, the reviewers and the editors are asking, is this work rigorous? Is it ethical? Are the conclusions justified? Is it properly reported? In other words, does this work belong in the scientific literature? And if the answer is yes, then we'll publish it in PLOS One. And so what they're not doing, what the reviewers and the editors aren't doing, is asking, how important is this? And is it relevant for my audience? Those questions about impact assessment. And the idea is that there are other ways you can do that after publication using various online tools and techniques. So what's happened since the launch is pretty spectacular. So this is just showing the quarterly publications since the launch at the end of 2006. So you can see that there was very steady growth, very, very healthy growth. up until about Q2, Q3 last year. In 2009, we published around 4,400 articles. But what happened at that inflection point? There are obviously no prizes for guessing that. That's when PLOS ONE got its first impact factor, which we didn't publicise, has no meaning whatsoever when it comes to, or very little meaning when it comes to PLOS ONE, because PLOS ONE is attempting to create a microcosm of the literature in a sense, all the way from the incremental stuff through to the really impactful stuff. And the premise is that you can sort that out after publication. And indeed, we have that kind of a range. And so an impact factor has no meaning. But what happens when you get an impact factor just demonstrates the slavish adherence to this metric. So it took a big turn upwards. So it's quite remarkable how much it's grown. So Q3 this year, we're approaching 4,000 articles in a single quarter. And just to sort of look at the numbers from an annual point of view, we actually published, I don't know where those numbers came from, but we published 6,700 articles in 2010, I mean the articles in the previous talk. But these are the correct data. There are 6,700 articles in 2010, which made PLOS ONE the biggest peer-reviewed journal. And this year we're on target to publish over 14,000 articles, which, you know, is around 1.5% of PubMed. Which is really quite remarkable, and it's still growing, you know, as you can see, at quite a rate. But it's not just about quantity with PLOS ONE. The goal, as I say, is to publish a range of content all the way from the incremental through to the sort of what you might call more important. This shows the distribution of citations based on Scopus data for articles published in 2009. So I've given, you know, the 2 years have elapsed, roughly, to allow citations to accumulate. And you can see there's over 900 articles that have got more than 10 citations, 10 or more citations. So that's a lot of content that's, you know, people are really paying attention to and citing and so on. At the one extreme, at the other extreme, there's a similar number of articles that have been cited zero or once. So, you know, perhaps the less important at this point articles. And so, you know, whether you look at it from the perspective of the quantity or the quality of the content, PLOS ONE seems to be working and seems to be really resonating with at least a fair chunk of the research community. And of course, that success hasn't gone unnoticed. And the first publisher to look at this model and to emulate it was BMJ. Just over a year ago, they announced the launch of a clinical science version of PLOS ONE called BMJ Open. And then a bunch more have appeared, scientific reports from MPG, Biology Open from the Royal Society, a social science version from SAGE, and I think a rather interesting example from a much smaller publisher, the Genetics Society of America, who've launched G3, a genetics version of PLOS ONE. Now, because, you know, this PLOS ONE has grown so very quickly and so very large, the term mega journal has been coined. I'm not sure who can claim the credit for that, or who'd want to claim the credit for that. But in any case, the things that these potential mega journals have in common are that they're open access, they're peer reviewed for rigor rather than impact. A lot of the time, people talk about post-publication mechanisms to sort content out, such as article-level metrics. They're supported by publication fees so that they are scalable. In other words, a publication fee covers all of the costs and a bit more, so they're actually profitable. So, you know, as they grow, the costs grow, the revenue grows with that. You've got a very scalable situation, which is, as long as it's operationally scalable as well, is unconstrained and can really grow very large very quickly. And the list of these journals continues to grow, not surprisingly. Everyone is getting on board with this. Although, it's fair to say that some of them, as I've highlighted here, are emphasising some degree of selectivity in terms of impact, in terms of importance. It's not clear precisely where the bar is being put, but for these kinds of examples, that is mentioned, and so that will, to some extent, presumably constrain the growth of those journals. So there are some colleagues were generous enough to share some data on what's actually happening with some of these journals. So I've shown that here. The sort of zigzaggy line at the top, that's the early history of PLOS ONE publications month on month. And then underneath you can see journals like AIP Advances, Scientific Reports, Sage Open, G3, BMG Open. You know, the other journals are certainly publishing respectable numbers of articles. Remember, they've only just been launched. If you look at the submission side, the situation actually looks slightly different. So two of those journals, in particular, AIP Advances in Scientific Reports, are maybe rising above the rest a little bit and approaching the kinds of data we saw for PLOS One. And I just want to importantly acknowledge the people that were good enough to share the data there. It's clearly very early days. There's some different fields involved here, so there's going to be some different field-specific effects going on and so on. But I'd say it looks encouraging for these journals so far. And, you know, just going back to this picture, if 10, 20, 30 of these journals, take off in the way that PLOS One's taken off over the past 5 years, the impact, you know, PLOS One is now 1.5% of PubMed. The impact on our industry is potentially profound, really profound. And so I think that's something that's obviously everyone, lots of people are thinking about that and how to respond and get involved. Okay, so but PLOS One doesn't do everything. These journals don't do all the things that journals do, and a lot of the things that journals do are important and valuable, and so we don't want to lose them. And so, you know, PLOS One creates a kind of sea of open content which isn't stratified or organized particularly well. It doesn't publish opinion and commentary. It doesn't build communities around content in the same way that journals do. So the question is, how then can you do that? How can you begin to build those functions in? And it goes back to this point that after publication online, especially with open content, there's all sorts of things that you can then do. And so I want to talk about two things, article level metrics and this idea of PLOS hubs. So first of all, article level metrics, which we introduced a couple of years ago. And it's not, you know, it's very straightforward. There's no magic here. But every article now published in PLOS has that tab called metrics from a couple of years ago. And if you click that tab, you go through a set of information about the usage. So this is just showing the total usage for this article broken down into HTML, PDF, and XML downloads. Underneath that is a graph showing cumulative monthly usage over time, and if you click on one of those blobs, you can see the usage broken down for that month in terms of the three things. And then we also provide, haven't shown it here, but we also provide some contextual information as well, because, you know, providing usage data is all well and good, but what does it mean, you know, for my article relative to an article published around the same time in the same field? Where am I in relation to this other content? So we provide some contextual information along those lines as well. And then scrolling down the page, there's information about citation, who cited this article, and all of those are links, so you can see what the list of citing articles is in Scopus, in PubMed Central, Crossref, and Web of Science. There's information about social bookmarking activity. There's also information about rating and so on that Adrian mentioned, and some indication of blog coverage. So that's fine. You know, you can provide some data on the article, and that's a useful first step. It doesn't immediately provide an alternative to the impact factor, clearly, but it's a useful first step. But it's also limited. There's only, you know, if the impact factor is limited, well, so is article level metrics. They're also limited. And here's one example. This is a paper that was published in PLOS Medicine, which is about methodology for determining the civilian impacts of conflicts, and it's called the Dirty War Index. And NATO decided to use this methodology in their assessment of conflict zones. Now, that's a really interesting impact of an article, and one that you would surely love to capture. You know, if you've got a reader comes, you know, we know what readers do. They search in Google or PubMed or whatever. They come to an article. If you can show them something like that, that this article has had this impact, it's had this amount of citations, and so on and so on, that this would be pretty valuable. So there's all sorts of things we want to do with article level metrics. This is really just a starting point. We want to increase the number of data sources. We want to address the kinds of impacts that are hard to measure. We're not experts in data analysis and so on, so people are using this data, so you can download the whole set of data from the site, and people are looking at it and analyzing it and studying it, and that will help us to provide more and better information. And obviously, ultimately, we want to see other people using it. It's all very well for PLOS to do this, and authors, the feedback from authors is really positive. But ultimately, you know, we want to see other people using it, other publishers. And this is already beginning to happen. And then the people who currently use impact factors or just journal names as methods of assessment to adopt these kinds of tools as well to generate more effective and more meaningful measures of research impact. Okay, so that's the first post-publication tool. The second post-publication tool I want to talk about is PLOS Hubs, which we launched a pilot of a year ago in the field of biodiversity. And the idea is very simple. Essentially, you know, imagine all this open content, especially provided by PLOS One and all these other open journals. It's a sea of open content. What the hub is a kind of meta journal superimposed on that sea of content. So you can ingest and select content in different subject areas, and so that's its primary function. It's just the simple idea of aggregating content after publication and then enriching the content. You can imagine all sorts of ways of enriching the content, building communities around content, and so you can begin to see that these are some of the ways we're thinking about providing the values and functions that journals currently provide, but doing it at a different point in the process. And all the while, this demonstrates the kind of potential and power of open access, because there's no limit to what you can do. So this is the homepage for PLOS Hub's biodiversity. There's a group of curators, academic curators on the right, who help to run it. This is an article page. And so it looks really like a PLOS journal. There's a full text article there, but it's not, because you look at this article and it's published in Microbial Ecology, which we don't publish. So that may be the first indication that this isn't a journal in a traditional sense. There are metrics provided. And then one of the ways in which we've added value as a kind of demonstrator here is to add information about species, some of the species that are mentioned in the article. This is a biodiversity hub, after all. This is an article about vultures. And so if you click one of the species names, you get taken to a page of information which is sort of drawn in from different databases, taxonomic information from a resource called ITIS, open access images from Flickr, species descriptions from Wikipedia, genetic sequence information, and then an interactive map which is showing the positions of museum specimens for that particular organism. So, as I say, this is very much a pilot. This is not, the real deal, but it's an attempt to kind of show a direction. There's all sorts that we want to do and plan to do. To enhance and automate that content enrichment, for example, to develop the notion of a community and use hubs to build communities. At the moment, all the content that's being ingested is being ingested from PubMed Central. That's a limitation. And clearly, we have to go beyond PubMed Central if hubs are going to work and be useful. And ultimately, the vision is that we want hubs to be really easy to replicate, so that anyone in this room could create their own hub, a lab could create a hub, a society, or whoever. And depending on the criteria that are used to select the content to go into the hub, it might actually become rather valuable to an author to be able to say, well, my article is actually featured in this, rather influential hub over here that was selected by this society. And so the hub, you can see the way in which the hub might replace some of those functions, again, that journals have provided. So I'm going to wrap up now. This is sort of the traditional sort of simple view of how it works now, the article cycle. You've got this big blue box where data is obtained, and it goes to this blue box, and that's the massive filtering mechanism that eventually spits the article out into a particular journal, and it's the journal that is the be-all and end-all in terms of research assessment and everything that matters. That's where we are now. What I've tried to show you is that if you do separate this idea of impact and technical assessment, the blue box can become much shorter. The process that you need to go through to go from obtaining data to publishing that data is a much shorter process. And then after publication, instead of focusing on the journal, you're focusing on the article, you're adding value to that article through approaches like article level metrics and hubs and countless other methodologies as well. And so, I think we've shown that you certainly can separate these two aspects of peer review, that idea is really resonating with a large fraction of the community as well, the research community. that you can use post-publication mechanisms, although I completely agree we haven't done it yet, but I think we pointed in a direction which is promising to enhance and organise content, and that the end result is that research communication potentially is increased in terms of speed and potentially efficiency and potentially reduced cost because of the there's less redundancy in the system, and that research itself ultimately will benefit too. And maybe just again repeating for the benefit of this audience that earlier point that, you know, we talked about rapid evolution. I don't know whether it's rapid evolution or revolution, rapid evolution or revolution, but it's fast, whatever it is potentially. We are potentially poised for something very dramatic, I think, in terms of the way research is communicated in our industry. So I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.